This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the naturalist Mark Durr, speaking with us today about the prehistoric wolf evolving into the poodle and the chihuahua. Your new book, Mark, comes with the title, How the Dog Became the Dog. And I leave it to you to tell us where and why and how far back in time we can begin to look for signs of metamorphosis.
Those are the great questions facing us if we try to figure out how the wolf became a dog and how the dog became a dog. My feeling is, after studying all of the evidence, which is frequently contradictory, in that you have people proposing the dog originating between 12 and 15,000 years ago, 16,000 years ago, 22,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, 135,000 years ago. And if you look at all those dates, they do fit with early humans, and they furthermore point to what I think is the fundamental truth, and that is that as soon as humans and wolves met on the trail of the big game they were hunting, they began to get together, and you have the start of what inevitably becomes a dog. The recognizable dog probably appears, I think, around 40 or 50,000 years ago, and that has to be provisional because dates are constantly changing as more information is uncovered.
What kind of evidence do you use? Archaeological, genetic, paleontological? What?
I try to use archaeological evidence, genetic evidence, behavioral evidence. One of the big developments in ethology in recent years has been the more complete recognition of these animals as having volition, being creatures who can think and act on their own. And so we have to look at a situation in which wolves and humans get together not as species but as individuals, and what happens when they do so. So there's the behavioral evidence of both wolves and humans, the genetic evidence, the archaeological evidence, and then trying to piece that in with what was happening in the world at that time. Remember, we're approaching the last glacial maximum around 20 or 30,000 years ago.
All right, so where did the two wandering bands, the wolves and the early man, meet one another? What part of the world?
Well, as far as we can tell, early man, meaning our ancestors now, our direct ancestors, Homo sapien, came into the Middle East from North Africa. And the dates vary here. The one I like is around 135,000 years ago, some came. They may have stayed low in the Middle East until 40 or 50,000 years ago. You get these wide discrepancies, you see, and it becomes difficult to sort between them. So I try to pick a middle course and say probably wolves and humans met when humans first entered the Middle East, and from there you set in train this course of events where highly sociable wolves, and we know that wolves can be highly sociable, and we know that they can be tamed even as adults because there were researchers in this country who did it in the 1960s. And highly sociable wolves and highly sociable humans got together occasionally, and over time, some of the wolves might begin to reproduce in human society. Not always, and certainly those lineages would not necessarily continue because you have to have, you know, breeding stock around you. But I think that some did gradually become what I call dog wolves, that is, dog-like wolves. And from these populations of dog wolves emerged animals who, when humans started spreading across the world at the end of the last ice age, began to breed with each other more than with wild wolves. And from these populations came the dog. And the dog came about, we are pretty certain, as a result of the capture of unique mutations that had what geneticists call a large effect, so that one mutation in one gene causes smallness in dogs. And the first divide in dogdom, I think, was between small and large dogs.
The wolf is large.
Some wolves are large. The Middle Eastern wolf, who seems to be at the root of dogs genetically, can go down to about 25 or 30 pounds. So that's getting close to what a small dog is. The larger wolves are in the north, of course, in the Arctic, and those animals can get to be quite large. But remember, in the spectrum of the dog world, you have 2-pound chihuahuas and 200-pound mastiff. So dogs effectively can be both much smaller and larger than wolves.
When humans and wolves come together, what is the basis of their companionship?
The basis of it first is that wolves and humans had a very similar social structure. The wolf pack is basically a family, mom, pa, the breeding pair. They're the juveniles who are getting ready to disperse at age about 3, and they're the pups of the year. And the pack exists to raise those puppies. They hunt together. They act cooperatively in most regards. The early human band of hunter and gatherers was basically an extended family, which also had to hunt cooperatively and gather food cooperatively. So you get this kind of matching social structure. And on top of that, it seems the case that wolves and humans, and then dogs and humans certainly, just understand each other at a very fundamental level. They actually like each other.
I remember Rudyard Kipling wrote The Jungle Book, where he has a young man, Mowgli, raised in a family of wolves. Could we say that that was a probably good guess at the sociability of the wolf?
Probably. The legend of the child being raised by wolves is common. You remember Rome was founded by Romulus and Remus, who were raised by a wolf. And it certainly is a common tale, the wolf child. I don't think that it actually happened, but it does indicate, as you say, the affinity of the two species, that they can feel comfortable together.
Take us further along the road to the dog. About how long ago do we begin to distinguish the dog from the wolf?
I assume you're talking here in terms of appearance rather than behavior.
Yes, I'm talking about appearance.
There certainly are some dogs who look very much like wolves. What the genetic evidence shows now is that this genetic mutation for smallness was probably captured or fixed in a population of dog wolves around 50,000 years ago. And the gene itself came from Middle Eastern wolves. And surveys of the whole genome of wolves and dogs from various places around the world indicates that the Middle Eastern wolf is at the base of this animal, the dog, with significant contributions from the Chinese wolf and from the large European wolf. There were probably others involved too, but I think the first kind of changes in appearance probably began around 40 or 50,000 years ago. We know that by 33,000 years ago, there was an animal that was clearly not a wolf and may not have been fully a dog, found in Belgium. And similar animals have been found across the north of Europe and into Siberia, actually, dating from about 30-some thousand to 20-some thousand years ago. So these physiological changes probably began earlier than that, and they resulted from inbreeding of these populations of dog wolves, probably for lack of wolves, wild wolves to breed with. And humans, seeing something that they liked, would try to encourage its perpetuation.
How do we get so many different breeds of dog? I mean, when does that begin to happen? How many breeds are there, by the way, of dogs now in the world?
There are something on the order of 400 recognized breeds. There are probably more than that if you count what are called land races, which are types of dogs that have grown up in specific areas and have a particular kind of features. I think 400 plus is a fair number of, to say, breeds of dogs. The great size range has long been a mystery, but it appears to be due to the efforts of breeders beginning in the late 18th century who engaged in scientific breeding and tried to create different types of dogs or to improve on nature so that they would take, let us say, 3 or 4 varieties of herding dog from around Paris and try to combine them into one dog that would become the kind of perfect specimen of all Parisian herding dogs. It's rather a nutty notion if you think about it. It was done and done repeatedly so that you get these extremes, these what Darwin would have called hopeful monsters if they had arisen in the wild. But because they were in human society and under the care of humans, they could be kept alive.
then in the ancient world, let's say ancient Mesopotamia or Egypt or Greece or Rome, are there relatively few species of dog in those civilizations?
In some areas, for considerable time, there were basically three types of dogs. There were the small dogs, which seemed to be prized by people both as companions and as ratters and other vermin eaters in the household. There were large dogs, which were used for hunting and hauling, and there were your kind of medium-sized dog, what we now call the pariah or village dog, say an animal 30 to 50 pounds. In certain areas, as you say, in Greece and Rome, there were other types of dogs that arose. I think there are probably four or five fundamental types, if you count the large mountain dog, the mastiff type dog. They're very similar, big burly dogs with stocky legs and big heads. You had sight hounds like the greyhound or the saluki or the Afghan hound, and you had these pariah dogs, these village dogs like the Canaan dog, the Basenji, the dingo, and one or two other basic types that probably are related to the founding wolf stock mix, the mix of Middle Eastern wolves and wild wolves that gave you this kind of unique build. And from those animals in certain areas, you would get variations, local variations on the theme based upon who was available to breed with. But most of the sorting of dogs was done by function. So that in ancient Greece, for example, black dogs were wanted to be home guards because it was believed that they could come out of the darkness and surprise intruders and scare them away. Even to this day, there are people who have a very great fear of black dogs, and it often is hard for shelters to find homes for them. By the same token, white dogs would be chosen to guard the flock, or light-colored dogs to guard the flock. And then you would choose dogs for other purposes based on their ability.
Is there any particular difference in attitude among cultures? I mean, do the Romans have a different attitude toward dogs than the Greeks or, let's say, the Italians of the Renaissance?
Certainly there were cultural differences in the way people approach dogs, just as there are now. The Greeks seem to be fond of their dogs, for sure. The Romans also, and both of them tended to sort dogs by what we would call broad breeds or types. I think that in general, the traditions of dogs in Western Europe and thus in America after the settlement were quite different from the traditions of dogs in, say, Africa or even in Asia. Although in Japan and in parts of China, certainly dogs were maintained as breeds, the breeds were often related to locales rather than to broader types of dogs, if you follow me.
The Chinese also eat dogs, as did the Native American Indians in our continent.
Some of Native Americans ate dogs, others of them did not. And the real big dog eaters in American history were Lewis and Clark and their expedition. They consumed vast quantities of dogs. Lewis, who took a dog with him across the continent, actually preferred dog meat to all other kinds except for bison, whereas Clark would rather go hungry than eat a dog. You find that in their journals. If you go through and read the journals, you see one copying from the other, you know, entry after entry until they get to the part about what they ate. And Lewis will say, "We had dogs and it was very good." And Clark will say, "I just can't eat dogs."
Lewis's dog was a Newfoundland, I believe, and Audubon also had a Newfoundland dog. Was Newfoundland dog a very popular dog in the 19th century?
The Newfoundland dog seems to have been enormously popular. There were two types. One was a larger one, which is what we call the Newfoundland, and the other was what was called the St. John's Water Dog that became the Labrador, the Curly Coat Retriever, the Chesapeake, and one or two other retrievers. They basically were the same dog, I think. They were what one might call water curs. They were kind of working dogs. They kept their type. One was big and one was smaller. One had a thicker coat than the other, but basically they interbred, and the separation came as a result of human intervention.
What about people who keep dogs as emblems of their own social status?
Well, Veblen, of course, you know, gave us a term for that, didn't he? Objects of conspicuous consumption, because the dogs were difficult to breed, difficult to maintain, and had no intrinsic worth. They simply had the value that was affixed to them by somebody willing to pay big money for them.
Some of those dogs being like what? I mean, very small.
Oh, like dogs. A Pekingese or some little, what we would call a little yappy dog. But a small dog, the Pekingese was one, and certainly there are others. Bear in mind that at that time, the end of the 19th century, a small dog was not the one we see today, where they've become even more miniaturized. But they were hard to breed, and they were rare. A purebred dog in the early 20th century would cost more than most people made in a year.
How many dogs are there in the world at the moment, roughly, and how many wolves?
Wolves, the last number I saw, it seems to stick in mind, was around 500,000, maybe. These are wild wolves. There are a lot of wolves in captivity. Dogs, I estimated there might be upwards of 1 billion dogs in the world. Other people have put it at about half that. So I would say 500 million to 1 billion dogs would be a fair, rough estimate. Certainly, dogs are everywhere in the world except Antarctica, where they are banned by international treaty.
Why?
To protect the seals, basically. There's a fear that dogs would bring in parasites and other diseases that would harm the seal population, especially there. Dogs were on Antarctica for a considerable time during the effort to get to the pole, and it was common to feed them vast numbers of seals from the ice shelf there. And then, of course, on the way back from the expedition, it was frequent that the dogs would be fed to each other.
We come now to the end of the road from the prehistoric, fierce, wild wolf of the north, let's say, and now man's best friend. What are the characteristics of the dog that give people reason to call him man's best friend?
Well, you know, there are people who think that dogs are all about love. I'm not one of them. I believe that what it is that there's a deep empathic understanding that exists between dogs and humans. We just understand each other at a level that is certainly probably pre-verbal, but dogs clearly understand what we're saying if we talk to them. If you have dogs yourself, you know that you can just talk to them and they understand pretty much what you're saying. But we also understand what dogs say. There have been studies that show that people can understand what a dog's bark means. Even people who don't own dogs can understand that. I had a dog once who could remember for months where every ball in the house was, every one of her tennis balls was, even if it was hidden behind some piece of furniture that hadn't been moved in years. You know, somehow it had wormed its way back there. And she would sit in front of wherever the ball was and heave her stomach and make little chirpy noises until we looked. And invariably, she was correct. If we just followed her nose, we would find this ball.
You've over your lifetime had many dogs, different kinds of dogs. Did they have recognizable specific personalities, each of them?
Oh, each dog I've had has had a very distinctive personality. They're all memorable in their way. The last one who died in September, we actually called Two Brain. She was an Australian Kelpie, and she was, I think, a genius among dogs. Others of my dogs have not been that way, probably fortunately, because as a genius, she was a little hard to deal with sometimes. I had one dog who was completely phobic toward thunder and any other loud noise and became totally destructive. I had another dog who took offense if anyone wore a hat in the house. He would climb up and remove the hat from their head.
On that note, thank you, Mark Durr, for speaking with us today about how the dog became the dog. This is Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.